Welcome back for the second hour of Issues Etc. In the first 25 minutes, Dr. Bruce Ware joins us from Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. We're going to talk about open theism. This is, well, it came to my attention about 5 years ago when at theological conferences among evangelicals, there were these viewpoints about God being raised, and it caused some alarm. Who is God? To what degree does he know the future? To what degree is the future still an unwritten book, even for God? Now, it might shock you to hear that evangelical theologians were entertaining these questions, but open theism has not broken its pace in the last 5 years. We'll find out exactly what this view of God is and its major dangers in the first 25 minutes of this second hour of Issues Etc. After our conversation with Dr. Ware, Jennifer Roback Morris will join us from the Hoover Institute. We're going to talk about abortion, Hispanics, and the California recall election. We're only one day away. That's in the second half hour. In the third hour, it's open lines for your questions and your comments. Well, one of the biggest stories over the weekend, going into the weekend as well, was radio talk show host Rush Limbaugh. Now, the ESPN story was what got all the headlines burning, but the follow-up story was even more interesting, and I'll be quite frank with you, it was very saddening to me, and that is that Limbaugh had been at least alleged to have been buying prescription drugs on the black market through employees, a housekeeper in particular. When the story broke, I was very curious, found very little on the internet about it, and then later that afternoon it was all over the place, and it was all the buzz. Had dinner with some friends that evening, and that was a subject of conversation, among other things. I listened intently Friday when Rush returned to the air for his regular nationally syndicated radio program, wondering whether or not he would have anything to say, and I'll be quite honest with you. I was already saddened by the allegations. I was disappointed by what he had to say. I'll share that with you during Open Lines if you didn't hear it for yourself. And I've got these questions for you to answer during that hour of Open Lines. First of all, if the allegations of buying drugs illegally are true, has Rush Limbaugh lost moral authority in your eyes? What do you make of how he's handling this? Some are saying Clinton-esque. He's deflecting the actual question that his listeners have, do you have a drug problem, into questions of whether or not he's being investigated for it. If these allegations are true, will you be less likely to listen to Rush? If he loses sponsors and therefore affiliates, will that be a setback for Christianity in America? Those are the questions I'd like to have your answers to. In the third hour of Issues Etc., open lines for your questions and your comments. Dr. Bruce Ware is Senior Associate Dean and Professor of Christian Theology at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. He's author of a new book titled Their God is Too Small, Open Theism and the Undermining of Confidence in God. Dr. Ware, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Ware, what is open theism in a nutshell?
Well, the term open theism, the open word in there gives it away. It's the notion that the future is open in the sense that God not only hasn't determined what the future will be, but in most respects does not even know what the future will be. He only finds out as his creatures make their decisions and perform their actions, and then he learns just as we do what happens moment by moment and day by day.
Is this just a rehash of something that was really rather popular at the turn of the last century? It was usually called process theology, this notion that God is kind of making it up as he goes along.
Yes, well, it does have some strong affinities to process theology, but it really is an evangelical version of it. That is, process theologians are liberal theologically on almost everything they believe, whereas open theists are not. They are evangelical in their convictions regarding the deity of Christ and the necessity of faith in Christ and so on, but they hold this view that in order for us to have legitimate freedom, then it must be the case that God cannot know what we are going to decide until we make those decisions, which of course conflicts with the entire history of the Church's opinion on this doctrine, whether it's Roman Catholic, Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, Greek Orthodox, Protestant, every version of Protestant. All of the Church, through all of its history, has held that God knows all things that can be known, including his knowledge of the future exhaustively.
I remember sitting in a seminary class, being very early in my seminary years, when we were going through the attributes of God, and the seminary professor said, God not only knows what was and is and will be, he knows what wasn't and isn't and won't be.
Yeah, that's right.
He not only knows what will be, he knows even things that that will not occur. He knows every contingency. His knowledge is absolutely and utterly complete.
Yes.
In regard to all things.
That's right. And of course, all Christian people have held that. The only significant group in the history of the Church that has held what the openness advocates hold today is a group at the end of the Reformation period called the Socinians. And they were rejected as a heretical group primarily because they rejected the Trinity, the doctrine of the Trinity. But one of their other beliefs was that God could not know the future, free actions of human beings. And other than the Socinians, you do not find this view held anywhere else in any substantive way in the history of the Church. So open theists have really opened a can of worms that, in a sense, for the Church and for its theology, is a new one to deal with at this point in our history.
Why are they putting this viewpoint forward?
Well, I think what compels them is the idea that unless the future is open, if God knows, for example, what your hearers are going to have for dinner this evening as they drive home and anticipate what that will be, if God knows what they're going to eat, then they cannot choose otherwise because his knowledge is infallible. And so in order for them to choose the meal that they want to eat for dinner tonight, then God must not know it. And, of course, Christian people all through the centuries have denied the logic of that argument. They have said that God can know what we are going to do, and yet we do it freely. Much as you know what you had for breakfast this morning, and yet that doesn't mean that what you ate for breakfast you had to. You were free in eating otherwise, and yet you now know what it was that you had for breakfast. So in a similar way, people have always argued that it's compatible to hold in divine foreknowledge and our freedom.
Do advocates of open theism, do they believe that this is a limit that God has placed on himself with regard to his foreknowledge, or do they believe that there is, I don't know if how to put this,
a logical necessity?
In other words, is God limiting himself in his knowledge, or is he limited in his knowledge?
Good question. Actually, believe it or not, Todd, it is both. And here's why. They hold that God cannot, that is, it's logically impossible for God to know what a free creature is going to do before he does it or chooses it. Now, could God have created a world in which he determines everything? Well, yes, and in that case, he could know what everyone is going to do in the future. He could know the future exhaustively if he determined it all. But they hold that God has chosen to limit himself by not determining everything, and therefore he cannot know what choices are going to be made until they are made.
Does the error of open theism touch only upon God's knowledge, his, as we would say, his omniscience?
Well, this is the heart of what distinguishes open theism from any other version of understanding of the Christian faith. And it's just amazing, as you begin thinking about it, the implications of this to everyday Christian life. For example, how can you really trust a God who makes decisions and then looks back perhaps at his own past actions and says, wow, if I had known this, if I had known things would turn out this way, I would have acted differently myself? Or a God who you pray to for divine guidance. And God does give you that guidance. But, of course, God doesn't know what the future is going to hold, and things don't turn out like he thought they would. And so you realize you're in this big jam because you followed God's guidance. You end up with a God that is diminished, a God that is too small, as the title of my book would indicate. And it's a God really not worthy of Christian devotion, worship, and trust.
Dr. Bruce Ware is our guest. He's Senior Associate Dean and Professor of Christian Theology at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky, and he's author of this book called Their God is Too Small, Open Theism and the Undermining of Confidence in God. Open Theism is the subject of our conversation. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. What do the open theists do with prophecy?
Ah, this is a great question, Todd. They have a hard time with prophecy, to be honest with you. It's one of the areas where you see the weakness of the openness view, because the only way they can explain prophecy is to say that either God has a very good guess about things that are going to happen, or his prophecies, his predictions, have built-in conditions. In other words, there's always a back door for God to say, it doesn't have to happen because things didn't work out the way that I thought they would. Let me give you one example. Greg Boyd, in his book entitled God of the Possible, he's an open theist. Greg Boyd explains how Jesus could predict Peter's threefold denial of him. Remember Jesus said to Peter, before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times? Well, Greg Boyd says, here's how Jesus could predict that. He knew Peter's character very well. He knew the kinds of things that Peter would do. Now, the problem with that, there are many problems, but the main one is the three denials. How could Christ know, by knowing Peter's character very well, that, say, after one denial, Peter wouldn't feel so horrible, so guilt-ridden, that he would go out and kill himself the way that Judas did? How did Jesus know that maybe John and James wouldn't be with him and Peter would just sit quietly and not say anything, not deny anything at all? How could Jesus know three denials? And the explanation that Boyd gives is just simply not sufficient.
Lucky guess?
A lucky guess, yes. He had a much better basis for knowing Peter than we do. And, of course, that is true. But on the basis of that, can he predict three denials?
What I'm wondering about is whether or not the open theists can honestly say, we stop at this point. In other words, we have to view God's knowledge of the future as limited.
Yes.
And we can just stop at that and say that's all that's limited about God's knowledge, or that's the only way in which God is limited. Can they logically stop when they start diminishing these absolutes regarding the Godhead?
Oh, another very good question, Todd. You're right. I don't think that there is a logical stopping place to this. I have raised a passage with open theists a number of times. It's in Genesis 18, where God says to Abraham, I'm going to go down to Sodom, and I'm going to see if the evil that has been reported to me is as bad as what I have heard, and when I get there, then I'll know. Now, I say to these open theists, why not hold that God not only doesn't know the future, but he doesn't know the past? He doesn't know the present. And for that matter, he is not omnipresent. That is, he's not everywhere present. He has to go to Sodom, travel there, and until he gets there, he won't know what's happening there. I mean, that's sort of like me saying, I live in Louisville. Until I go to Chicago, I don't know what's happening there. Is God limited in these ways? But that's the way they interpret these passages that they say indicate God learns new things. Well, that same kind of interpretation would lead us to all kinds of denials of God's glory and greatness.
I'm deeply concerned because from the outset of my exposure to this, and that was actually through Boyd's book, God of the Possible, when I first read this, my mind immediately went to how this impacts the teaching of the cross.
Yes.
And if God is kind of working the rest of history via guesswork, kind of watching it unfold before his eyes, ignorant as to what's going to happen, how can he promise all the way from Genesis, the third chapter, to our first parents, that he would send one who would defeat Satan in our stead and be the Savior of all the world, Jesus Christ, his own Son.
Yes. Well, and Todd, let me just make the question harder. It didn't start in the Garden of Eden, because we know, for example, from Ephesians 1:4, that we were chosen in Christ before the foundation of the world. That is, before God even created, he knew there would be sin. He knew that he had planned for Christ to come, and he knew those who would be saved because of it. Before the foundation of the world. Similar statements are made in 1 Peter 1:20, and there's this statement in the book of Revelation about the Son who was slain before the foundation of the world. So how could God know these? You know, Sanders, John Sanders, in his book, The God Who Risks, argues that when sin happened in the Garden of Eden, God was taken by surprise. The implausible happened, says Sanders. Now, I submit to you this is ridiculous. This makes a mockery of the plan of God for our salvation that stems all the way from eternity past and is accomplished in the Son that the Father sends, whom we know is Jesus the Messiah.
Moving then to the other end of the eternal spectrum, can God's promises, if we adopt the open theist's view, can God's promises of eternal life and confirmed bliss for eternity because of the merits of Jesus Christ at the cross, for all who believe in him, can those promises be trusted if you're an open theist?
You know, this is another very difficult problem that open theists have. Number one, they cannot, even though they give verbal assurance, they cannot ground the assurance they give that God, in fact, will win in the end. How does God know at this point whether Satan will ultimately win a victory? Now, of course, there is the cross and the resurrection, and they believe in that, but in terms of the outworking of that, who will be saved? Who will be lost? How much evil will there be in this world? My goodness, the Holocaust, you know, you look at this and you think, wow, a lot of evil can happen, so how bad can it get before God brings it to an end? And they honestly do not have an answer to the question, can we be confident God will win? And then secondly, what about in eternity? What about in heaven? Well, if we have the same ability that God cannot know in advance what we will decide, maybe someday someone, maybe a bunch of people, will decide to turn away from Christ, turn away from God in heaven. Do they know that could not happen? And the answer is they don't. So, the subtitle of my book, The Undermining of Confidence in God, is at the heart of the problem of this open view.
The picture that emerges as I read the open theists is, and they tend to be somewhat whimsical about this, a God that delights more in kind of being surprised and
yes.
having an aha experience with
yes.
his creation than in saving fallen man through the blood of his Son.
Yes, well, Todd, to be fair to them, I don't know if it is a rather than, because I think that a Greg Boyd or a John Sanders would want to say, oh my goodness, God cares about that most, that is, about the salvation of lost people. I think that's true for them. But nonetheless, it's also true that God creates a world in which he revels in surprise. He revels in risk. I mean, you can see this in Greg Boyd's title, the title of his book, The God Who Risks. And you're right. Boy, when you think about it, this God who risks, risked a lot in not knowing how things would turn out in the end when he created the world. My goodness, is it possible that we would come to the end of history and rightly judge that God was a fool for having done this? Will the evil outweigh the good? So much that we would have to say that God would have to say that, like he did at the point of the flood, according to Sanders. According to Sanders, God had no idea things would get that bad, that he would have to bring judgment upon the whole world. Well, maybe that'll happen in the end as well. How does God know? He can't. So what confidence can we have in God and the certainty of the future hope that we have in him?
Someone is driving home from work, they're listening to this conversation on open theism, and they say, look, what's the big deal with open theism? It sounds like some sort of minor disagreement between theological types, the theologians. What's your response to that?
Well, it is a major disagreement among theologians, yes, not a minor, but it also has enormous practical, everyday Christian implications for our lives, whether we trust God, whether we find His Word reliable, whether we can believe His promises, whether we can put our lives into His hands. All of these questions are looked at entirely differently if you hold the view God cannot guarantee how things are going to come out. He cannot know right now that the advice He gives, that the actual work He does will bring about the best. It leaves Christian people wondering whether they ought to put their hope in God.
Dr. Bruce Ware, thank you very much for being our guest.
Well, it's been a great pleasure to be with you, Todd, and I trust that your listeners out there will continue to believe in the true God of the Bible, the one who declares the end from the beginning, as Isaiah 46 says.
Dr. Bruce Ware is Senior Associate Dean and Professor of Christian Theology at Southern Baptist Theological Seminary in Louisville, Kentucky. His book is called Their God is Too Small, Open Theism and the Undermining of Confidence in God. Scripture is quite clear, folks, that God, who has existed from all eternity and will to all eternity continue to be who He is, that this God has an eternal purpose. There has never been a time when this has not been God's purpose. And that purpose comes to fruition at the cross of His Son, Jesus Christ. That is where His purpose is carried out in this world, where His Son, long promised and eternally purposed to do so, in human flesh hangs dying on a cross for my sins and for your sins, for the sins of the whole world. After 3 days, according to God's divine foreknowledge and purpose, He comes alive out of the grave to proclaim eternal salvation, the forgiveness of sins, for all who believe in Him. This purpose of God, an eternal purpose, there's never been a time, if we could even speak of time in those terms of eternity, when God did not purpose this. This eternal purpose isn't just good intentions on the part of God. Well, I hope to do this sometime in the future if other circumstances don't get in my way, or I hope to do this. Could it be that God would say, God willing? No, this is His will. This is His purpose. This is the whole point from beginning to end. The God who says, I am the beginning, I am the end. Through His Son, He says, I am the Alpha and the Omega. He's not fooling around. He's not exaggerating. The great comfort of God's eternal purpose, that in Christ He chose you from the foundation of the world, and that purpose was carried out exactly as God's planned it. There is the great comfort of a God who not only knows the past and the present and the future, but also knows you through His Son, Jesus Christ, crucified for you. We'll be right back.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues, Etc. What motivated one man to stand against the most powerful institution of the 16th century? Why the relentless pursuit of Martin Luther to reform the church? Issues, Etc. and Concordia Publishing House invite you to delve into the life, writings, and teachings of Luther with our book of the month for October, Lift High This Cross, The Theology of Martin Luther. The book is published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can browse before you buy by going to our website, issuesetc.org, and click the What's New section. Find out how God worked through this reformer to shape church and society. Lift High This Cross costs $9.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. When you call or write, mention Issues, Etc., and our Book of the Month for October, Lift High This Cross.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Two of the nation's largest radio giants were fined last week by the Federal Communications Commission for indecency. But some are saying the penalties aren't big enough. Keith Peters has details.
Infinity Broadcasting received the largest fine ever for a single incident. Its station, WNEW, aired a segment of the Opie and Anthony radio show featuring a couple having sex at St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York City. The Catholic League's Louis Giovino says they're satisfied with the way the FCC handled the case.
We did ask that the FCC revoke the license of WNEW, but then Opie and Anthony were canceled and taken off the air. So we then said, well, we wouldn't really need the FCC to revoke the license of the station. We were satisfied they were canceled.
The FCC also issued a $55,000 fine against Clear Channel radio station WWDC for airing a segment where the host asked lewd questions of students at an Arlington, Virginia high school. FCC Commissioner Michael Copps called the fines a slap on the wrist. Tim Winter, executive director of the Parents Television Council, agrees.
The fines that have been imposed on these broadcasters is less than what they spend on coffee for their employees in a year. It's outrageous.
And Winter says these broadcasters won't get the message about these smutty shows until citizens get actively involved.
Silence equals acclamation of the behavior, and you can't be quiet. You have to express your voice, and when you band together, there is strength in numbers.
Federal law bars the airing of obscene material and limits broadcasting indecent material in an offensive manner. For Family News in Focus, I'm Keith Peters in Washington.
The fine for Infinity Broadcasting was $157,500. One of the participants in the St. Patrick's Cathedral radio stunt died last week of a heart attack at the age of 38. His girlfriend is expected to plead guilty to a minor charge in order to avoid jail time. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
On the next Midday Living Jubilee, live at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO. Join Paul Clayton and me, Diane Summers. We'll be talking with John Romeri, music director for the Roman Catholic Archdiocese, organist and choir master at the Cathedral Basilica, director of the Cathedral Concert Series on the St. Louis English Festival going on all this month. And Lindsay O'Connor joins us. If Mama Goes South, We're All Going With Her is her book. It begins at 11:05. Living Jubilee.
Issues Etc. and Concordia Publishing House are excited about our Book of the Month for October, Lift High This Cross, The Theology of Martin Luther. Find out how God worked through this reformer to shape church and society. Lift High This Cross, published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about this book at issuesetc.org and click the What's New section, issuesetc.org.
Welcome back. Last 25 minutes of this hour, we're going to be spending with Jennifer Roback Morse. She's author of the book Love and Economics, Why the Laissez-Faire Family Doesn't Work, and she's a research fellow at the Hoover Institute. She has written recently a column for National Catholic Register titled Abortion, Hispanics, and the Great Recall Election of 2003. She's speaking, of course, about the California recall election, which will be held tomorrow. Are there... Many have been watching this and saying, look, the big loser in this California recall is the pro-life issue because there's nobody there who is pro-life. It's a bunch of bad choices. We even didn't we do an hour of open lines on this very question, who would you vote for, given the possibilities if McClintock drops out and if you've got a pro-choice Republican versus a pro-choice Democrat in Bustamante and Schwarzenegger? Well, this will soon be answered, but until that time, maybe we should look closer at one of the factors that everyone in California is paying attention to, but has generally fallen under our radar, and that is the role of Hispanics in this recall election. Jennifer Roback Morse, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Glad to be here with you, Todd.
Tell us what you think the important role that Hispanic voters will play in the California recall election.
Well, I'll tell you, I wish I had a crystal ball, Todd, because this election is changing so fast. From the time you write one thing, some new factor pops up on the radar screen, so it's really hard to figure how the whole thing's going to go. But the one thing that's for sure, I think, is that there is a very small percentage of the total Hispanic electorate that's going to vote for Cruz just because he's Hispanic, you know. Maybe a quarter, maybe a third. And of course, Bustamante's campaign is dropping like a stone. You know, he's really, he's imploded. So the fact that he's Hispanic, people thought was going to help him, but it's turned out I think that's a big dud. Now, the place where it gets interesting is that so many Hispanic voters tend to be, of course, if they're voters, they're not illegal immigrants, okay? They're here legally if they're voting. And they've been documented, and they've gone through the hoops of becoming legal citizens in order to be able to vote. Oftentimes, a large part of that pool is also people who've been here for a generation or two. They've been here a long time. So they're much more Americanized than our identity politicians would ever give credit for. And many among the Hispanic community are really quite pro-life. And that's the interesting feature that has never really caught on in California politics. Nobody has paid much attention to that fact. But the fact is that the typical Hispanic in California certainly is not a raving pro-abortion fundamentalist, you know. And California now is priding itself, Gray Davis prides himself, on having made California the most pro-choice state in the union. And I think there are very few Hispanic voters who would go the whole distance with him, you know. So there's plenty of room, it seems to me, for negotiation on this point. There's plenty of room for somebody to raise some issues in a constructive way that will be attractive to this part of the electorate.
Now, the Hispanic voters are not only pro-life, they are also Roman Catholic predominantly. And not only just Roman Catholic, but as you point out in your column, they are fervently Roman Catholic.
Yes, that's right. They're unapologetically, fervently, devotedly Roman Catholic. I have often said that the Mexicans are going to save the Catholic Church in America if it can be saved. You and your listeners know that I am a Roman Catholic, and I'm sometimes discouraged by the Church. But these people are very, very devout people, and very devoted to the Church, and so they take it seriously. And when they leave the Catholic Church, they don't leave to become Episcopalians. They leave to become Pentecostals. They leave to become Evangelicals or something like that. They do not leave to go to one of the mainline, more liberal kinds of churches. So that's what makes me think that there is some possible traction or some possible staying power to the possibility of Hispanics being a block of solidly pro-life voters.
Is anyone in the pool of candidates, of course, laying aside the many hundreds or dozens that have no chance, is anyone of credibility in the pool of candidates for California governor in this recall election raising the abortion issue?
Not really. I mean, it's a perfunctory issue. You know, Tom McClintock says, "I'm pro-life and I'm the only pro-life person." But he doesn't talk about the issue. This campaign is not about that. I mean, this campaign is about fiscal issues primarily. And nobody's, McClintock doesn't bring it up. The other candidates don't particularly bring it up except to punch their ticket and say, "We're pro-choice," you know. And that's pretty much all that there is on that subject in this election. And I think the reason for that is that many people who consider themselves pro-life and to various degrees are afraid to touch this issue because they're afraid of being labeled extremists. Often the issue isn't important enough to them to put their necks on the line for it, you know. And they don't see, they've accepted the kind of polarized view that you're either pro-life or you're pro-choice. You either believe that life begins at conception or you believe that you have an unlimited abortion license right up until the baby's halfway out of the birth canal, you know. And, you know, that's just simply not true. Most American voters, most American people actually are kind of in the middle, you know. They're deeply troubled by abortion, but they think it should be legal in some circumstances and so on. So I think it's a mistake to think that there are no nuanced positions possible, you know, or that there are no moderate positions possible. I think most people, in fact, have rather moderate positions. But what has happened is that because of the dominance of the courts ruling out certain kinds of policy options, And because of the reticence of so many pro-life politicians, or I should just say politicians, to bring this issue up, the extreme pro-abortion people are not held accountable for their stuff in the way that they I think they ought to be held accountable for it. So in California, they pretty much, you know, they get to do what they want practically because nobody will say stop, and that is. That's not absolutely not necessary. I mean, I think these issues can be presented in a nuanced way that is appealing to people.
You write this: when Democrats talk about economic issues or entitlement issues or immigration issues, many Latinos respond. But when the subject is sex, family, or abortion, Latinos resonate with Republicans. One of our alternative newspapers here in California reports that many Hispanics don't realize that the Democrats are the party of abortion. Jim Holman's San Diego News notes clearly insinuates that Democrats strategically conceal their pro-abortion extremism from their Hispanic constituents. Now, that goes beyond just remaining mum on the issue.
Yeah, and it's almost hard to believe. You know, it's almost hard to believe because anybody who can speak English can certainly figure this out, you know. So it almost has to be. I think the way many in the Democratic Party view Hispanics is that these are clients for their welfare state programs, you know, and so they talk to them in certain kinds of terms. They pursue certain classes of people within the Hispanic community to be their clients, you know, people who need their help with immigration problems, people who need welfare, food stamps, what have you. And the more business leader type people within the Hispanic community, of whom there are many, you know, successful businessmen, successful farmers, those kind of successful professionals, those kind of people, you know, they're not going to be taken in by this kind of strategic emphasis on certain kinds of issues. And they quite often realize what's going on. I cite in my article one very recent case that took place where a few Hispanic Democrats will vote with Republicans on some kind of family issue or some kind of life issue. The particular one that took place recently was same-sex benefits to same-sex couples that Gray Davis signed into law with very little opposition. It was basically a straight party line vote, and the only party line crossovers were six Democrats who voted no, and of those six Democrats, four of them were Hispanic. You know, so there's something I think kind of striking about that there's a potential discomfort there with some of what is being peddled under the Democratic brand name.
We've mentioned Schwarzenegger and Gray Davis and Bustamante and also McClintock.
Yeah.
You also want to raise the issue of Warren Farrell, who's a Democrat, but tends to buck the trend when it comes to the abortion issue.
I'll tell you, Warren Farrell is a very, very iconoclastic guy because he calls them like he sees them. And the main thing he's interested in this life is father's issues. He's a father's rights, men's issues advocate. That's what he does. And one of the things that troubles him is the unilateral decisions that women are entitled to make in this society around things that have to do, anything that has to do with sex and childbearing. Women have been granted pretty much unilateral rights. So a woman can unilaterally decide she's going to have an abortion. Well, Warren Farrell thinks, you know, there's something a little twisted about that. He says, you know, look, if the father comes forward and says, I want to raise this child, I commit myself now to a lifetime of child support for this child, I want to raise the child, I want to take care of the child, then he should be allowed to do that. And Warren is saying, you know, look, there's something wrong with the situation where she can, if she chooses, bring the baby to life and then demand child support payments from this guy. But on the other hand, if he wants the baby and is willing to make the child support payments, she can nevertheless refuse to honor that and go ahead and have an abortion. So he's trying to introduce, he wouldn't put it this way, this is the way I would put it. What he's doing is really introducing the social aspect of the abortion decision out there for public discussion. We treat it like it's completely a private matter, the woman and her body. But the fact is, every sexual act involves two people, and the issue from the sexual act, the child, there's more than one person who's got an interest in that child. And so to say that one person unilaterally gets to decide without the father having any input, without grandma and grandpa having any input. You know, it's really, it's really a very unreal and very unrealistic perspective on the abortion question. And that's why I was hoping that more people would pay more attention to Warren Farrell, just because he has, he turns things upside down by bringing this point up.
But given the makeup of the pro-choice Democratic Party in California, is it any wonder that Warren Farrell is completely off the radar
right.
screen?
That's right. He, as a matter of fact, early in his campaign, he issued something like, I don't know, I don't think he had 95 theses, but he issued his theses that he wanted to tack to the Democratic Party door, you know, to get them to listen. To the fact that, you know, look, we're supposed to be the party of the downtrodden and the oppressed, but we're contributing to some people's oppression. This is not a good thing. Naturally, they weren't interested. But I do think he's on to a point that's extremely important. And by the way, he would not describe himself as a pro-life person, not at all. But I think it's important to see that there's always somebody else involved in the abortion decision. You know?
Does that tell you something about the pro-choice position, kind of the absolutism, that even someone who says, hey, I'm pro-choice, I got a real problem with abortion per se, but I do think fathers ought to have a say in this.
That's right. And they can't even let that guy in their tent, you know, because he's not pro-choice enough to be in their tent, you know. So, yeah, it does, I think, tell you something about it. And I think one of the things, I've been thinking about this, Todd, I think one of the things that has hindered our rational discussion about abortion is that abortion isn't really just a medical procedure. You know, that's what we're told. It's just a medical procedure. But, you know, if it was really just a medical procedure and everybody really believed that it was just a medical procedure, we would have done tons of research on who's a good candidate for abortion, who's more likely to have side effects, who's more likely to be distressed about it afterwards, who's more likely to regret it, so on and so forth. And you'd sit down, and they'd go through your stuff, and they'd say, you know what, you're not a good candidate for this procedure. You really need to solve your problem some other way because you're not a good candidate for this medical procedure because of medical reasons. Well, they don't talk to people like that, even though there are problems associated with post-abortion issues. They don't talk to people like that, and I think part of the reason that they don't is that the abortion on demand is part of a package, and the package is you are entitled to have unlimited sexual activity with only the consequences that you choose to have. See, that's the message that we've gotten from the whole of the sexual revolution, which of course includes the abortion people. You're entitled to have sex. And you're entitled to only have the consequences that you want. So if you don't want a baby, you are entitled to get rid of that baby. Never mind if it increases your probability of breast cancer, or it increases the probability of an eating disorder, or suicide, or depression, or anything like that. We can't mention that to you because that compromises our image that we're trying to create, that you're entitled. Say, you would no longer be entitled, or you would feel cheated if your sexuality was limited by the fact that, gee, this option might be a bad option for me.
So that even lie, I've often said on this program that the so-called woman's right to choose, I put that in big, fat quotation mark, that is, for the pro-choicer, the right that supersedes all rights and
right.
every rights. It is the cardinal right in their mind. But you're saying here that beneath that lies another assumption, another right that's being asserted, and that is sex without consequences, period, if
right.
that's what you want.
Right. And, you know, the interesting thing about it is now after 30 years of legal abortion, there are a lot of women who have had abortions that regret having their abortions, and there are now support groups and websites and lots of different things like that springing up on the Internet. If any of your listeners are hearing this, I would suggest they check out the Elliott Institute or Rachel's Vineyard, or any of these post-abortion trauma treatment centers, because there are a lot of women who found that, you know, it was my choice and it was a bad choice. I was devastated by this choice. And that information is starting to get out just because there are so many people who have had these kinds of experiences that you can't suppress all of that forever. It's not really a surprise that when you do something that is really at its core wrong to do, that you're going to have negative repercussions of it, of all kinds, you know, of all kinds. And so that is now finally becoming more clear in the public eye, and there are abortion survivors groups and things like that people are flocking to.
Jennifer Roback Morris is our guest. We're talking about abortion, Hispanics, and the California recall election. She's a research fellow for the Hoover Institution and author of the book Love and Economics, Why the Laissez-Faire Family Doesn't Work. It appears not to be only a California issue. You write, Latinos make up 15% of California's registered electorate. Mexican Americans are more pro-life and pro-family than the average voter. In one national poll, 50% of Latinos said Congress should put more limits on abortion. What are the nationwide implications of this?
Well, you know, I think, first of all, I think what's happening in California as far as the electorate is concerned is going to continue to be a factor in other places because, you know, obviously Hispanics are important here and in Texas and a few other places, but they're moving. You know, they're moving around. They're expanding into other states, and so other states are going to have to start really paying attention to the Hispanic vote. And George W. Bush has figured that out, as has his brother Jeb, that this is an important voting block that you cannot just write off and let the Democrats claim them as welfare state clients. And I think that nationwide poll, that's from a few years ago. I found that in a book, not on the internet, which is what you have to do to be totally up to date. But I think that general result is probably still right, you know, which is that the average Latino is much more connected, I think, to family than the average Yankee, you know, and they have the family values, they have the connectedness, and so on. And so, you know, the idea that their 13-year-old daughter is going to be able to leave school without anybody knowing it and go to get an abortion, you know, that's gross. That's just real gross, you know. And they're not going to sit there and say, "Oh, gee, yes, it's her right to choose." You know, they wouldn't let her go to the doctor by herself. You know, why would you be happy about that? And as soon as people start talking about that, you know, then you see, well, now, wait a second, maybe we have gone a little bit overboard. Now, you might be interested to know, and you can tell your listeners, you heard it here first, that I understand there is going to be another petition drive put forward by somebody here in California to put a parental notification bill on the next ballot. In other words, we're going to do another referendum, Todd, out here in wild and vote crazy California. Somebody is going to start a petition campaign to put parental notification on the ballot. And boy, you think this election's interesting. That election will be very interesting, I think. And some of my theories will have a chance to get tested, you know, if we watch how that whole thing plays out, how people vote for that or don't vote for it, you know, how that whole discussion goes. I think it should be very interesting to see the arguments back and forth and who they appeal to and so forth and so on. I think it will be a very constructive debate.
If you could have been in attendance at the last debate among the contenders for Gray Davis's job in California, what question would you have asked them on this subject, and who would you have asked that question?
Well, you know, one question, that's an interesting question. I might have asked Cruz Bustamante why the Davis administration had such a hard time deciding whether abortion providers were mandatory reporters of child abuse. There was a case like this where they were asked for clarification because it came out, and maybe your listeners have heard about this survey, that somebody was making phone calls to Planned Parenthood clinics and saying that she was 13 years old and that her boyfriend was 24, and could she come in for abortion? And they would always tell her, "Oh, yes, fine, come right in. No questions asked." So this raised the question of whether, in fact, they do check out statutory rape cases and whether they report them. And, you know, the California State's Attorney General has yet to rule on that. So I might have asked Mr. Bustamante, you know, why was this a close call? Why did you guys have trouble with this? Now, on the other hand, I might not have asked him that because then he'd have a turn at the mic, and that's always a bad idea to give your opponent a turn at the mic. I might have asked McClintock if he had some specific things that he would do that he thought that the voters of California would resonate with, and be interesting to hear what he said.
Finally, these Hispanic voters, we've got only 1 minute here before we go. These Hispanic voters, what should both pro-choice and pro-life politicians in California and nationwide remember about them?
Well, that they're here and that there's a lot of them and that they're not likely to change that much on this particular issue.
Jennifer Roback Morse, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you.
Jennifer Roback Morse is a research fellow for the Hoover Institution, author of the book Love and Economics, Why the Laissez-Faire Family Doesn't Work. She's also written a column in the latest issue of the National Catholic Register titled Abortion, Hispanics, and the Great Recall Election of 2003. You can read this column at the website for the National Catholic Register, ncregister.com. ncregister.com. When we come back from this break, we've got open lines for your questions and your comments. I have a series of questions, all related to the latest news about nationally syndicated talk show host Rush Limbaugh. Every time we talk about Rush, we get calls, because I know that a fair portion of our listening audience listens to Rush on a regular basis. Certainly you've heard that there are allegations made in the press about Rush Limbaugh and the abuse of prescription drugs, or at the very least, the purchase of prescription drugs on the black market through a drug ring in Florida where he lives. When I heard this, I was saddened. But I was more saddened to hear on Friday the way that Rush dealt with this issue. I was anxious, like probably all of his listeners were, to hear him say either yes or no. Yes, I have this problem. I have this vice. I have this addiction. Or no, I do not. I wasn't interested in whether or not he's being investigated, really. The biggest question was, is it true? Is it true? If these allegations are true, has Rush lost moral authority in your eyes? I want your answer to that question on the other side of this break, as well as this question. What do you make of how he's handling this big question everyone has and he seems to be unwilling to answer? Or, as he said today, because of the legal ramifications, perhaps unable to answer? Is he deflecting the real issue in talking about an investigation against him? If it's true, if the allegations are true, will you be less likely to listen to Rush Limbaugh? And if he loses sponsors and therefore affiliates, if he diminishes his voice here in the marketplace of ideas because of this, will it be a setback for Christianity? Those are my questions for you. I'd like your answers to those questions when we come back. The last hour of Issues, Etc., 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Call during this break. It's a great time to call and get in first. We'll be talking about Rush Limbaugh and the allegations of buying prescription drugs illegally on the black market. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Open Lines is next.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.